And that's why change is so hard, because it doesn't feel gratifying to relinquish parts of your privilege or parts of your power. Right. It doesn't feel fulfilling. But the thing is, when you do it with Christ at the center, it is absolutely fulfilling. It is absolutely gratifying. It is absolutely life-giving when you do this.
This is Scott. Welcome to the Theology Lab podcast. So far, this series has touched on topics of race and gender and evangelicalism individually. In this episode, though, we bring them right alongside one another. We're joined by Professor Kelly Carter Jackson. Kelly is Associate Professor of Africana Studies and the Chair of the Africana Studies Department at Wellesley College. She's also the author of Force and Freedom, and more recently, We Refuse, books that look at the politics around violence and the history of Black resistance. Kelly is very much a public intellectual. You can find her as a guest on CBS Mornings, CNN, and a host of other news outlets. Kelly is joined by Professor Beth Allison Barr. I think it's fair to say that Beth's book, The Making of Biblical Womanhood, is one of the most influential works that's ignited conversations on women and gender within evangelical spaces. This is a far-reaching conversation. As both historians and deeply committed people of faith, Kelly and Beth do something in this conversation that I think is somewhat unique. They are able, in one way, to show how deeply embedded we are in our past. On the topics of race and sexism, this shows up in that, despite good intentions, there are ways we have been formed that can still lead us to see and relate to our neighbor as strictly other, to continue to further pain and division. And yet, both Kelly and Beth speak to something better, the power of God in Christ to bring about change. There's a story here that if we ignore our histories, if we can't find the courage to see what's wrong, then we may also miss the kind of transformation that faith makes possible. As I think Beth and Kelly show, there's work to be done here, work in addressing racial justice and sexism in the church, and it's hard, but there's also a testimony to hope and how God can show up in the midst of it. Just a note, don't miss the Q&A at the end of this conversation. Kelly and Beth field questions that show how personal these topics are and how the livelihoods, callings, vocations of real people are at stake. They also share some thoughts on what ways forward might look like. If you enjoy the Theology Lab podcast, you can help us out by leaving a rating or review. Learn more about what is going on at Theology Lab right now at highrock.org/theologylab.
Actually, I remember when I was having a conversation, Kelly, with you about Beth's book, you were like, I love that book. And you were talking about Beth, you said she is out there like putting out fires on social media left and right. And this is like this comes at a cost. Step back and ask, what is it about your Christian faith that motivates you to do the work that you do?
Some people might say I was starting as many fires as I was putting out. So, you know, I don't know. Depends on what you think about my Twitter account. You know, as a historian, I've struggled with embracing what it means to be an activist also. Because there's a lot of folk who think that activism somehow somehow makes what we do as academics diminishes what we do as academics. And I've struggled with that. And I'm at peace with it, because I think the heart Christianity mm-hmm. is the heart of working towards the kingdom of God. Mm-hmm. And that is the heart of bringing the kingdom of God. And that means, you know, my husband's been preaching through the Sermon on the Mount, and I do not know how somebody hears the Sermon on the Mount and then stays silent mm-hmm. about helping the, all of the oppression in the world, poverty in the world. I just don't know how people listen to the Sermon on the Mount and don't become activists. Yeah. And so it seems to me that being the heart of what it means to me, a Christian, to be called to follow Christ is to be called to follow Christ, mm-hmm. which is actively working in this world as best as we can. And so I don't know how to separate my faith mm-hmm. from, well, I can quote James here, I don't know how to separate my faith from my works. Mm. And I think they go together. So I cannot be a Christian without being an activist.
Echo all of that. I think for me, it wasn't until college where I felt like I was living dual lives. One as like a sort of an academic or a scholar in the making, and the other as my Black Christian self. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I came into touch with James Cone and reading Black Liberation Theology, and I was like, oh my God, this is it. And I realized that, like, yes, God is the God of the oppressed, you know, that like the understanding and the experiences I have as a Black person are completely aligned with how I see Christ, how I see the cross. Mm-hmm. And it makes a lot of sense for me to be able to like have the platform that I do and speak in the way that I do about injustices, because I see slavery, I see racism, I see sexism. It's not just like evils, but a sin, you know, as yes. something that separates us from that. And so that makes it very easy, I think, to be able to call out things. And I think it makes it easier for other people to understand why you're doing what it is that you're doing when you see injustice in that way. It's not just a sort of social or economic separation, that it's also a spiritual separation as well. And so, yeah, people who associate with me may not be Christians, but they understand at least where my foundation comes from when I think about injustice.
And I, you know, Kelly, I love that. I wish Christians were known as being people concerned about injustice. Yeah, I mean, I just feel, I think why people hate evangelicalism right now is because it is known for being against things mm-hmm. and for standing against people instead of being standing for the love of Christ and fighting against injustice. And so I wish that's what Christians were actually known for.
Yeah. It's funny though, because I feel like the Black church is known for that. You know what I mean? The Black church is known for like activism and all of that stuff. But at the same time, that's why it's so hard for me as a Black Christian to be like, yeah, I'm evangelical. Like, they don't seem to be doing the same things, but essentially they should be.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And I think they don't want us to talk about it yet, but I think that gets into intersectionality. Yes. And when we think about intersectionality in the evangelical church.
Okay, let's move on to things that evangelicals feel awkward about. Let's talk about intersectionality. But actually, if you could like demystify that a bit and help us to see like how when you approach these topics, in some ways you're approaching topics that are related to others that are adjacent to it. There are shared concerns here. Yeah.
So I'm going to put on my academic hat. Yes. So Kimberly Crenshaw, a famous legal scholar, coined the term intersectionality. And it means a couple of things, but to be put it very simplistically, it means multiple identities, to have these multiple, you know, I'm Black, I'm a woman, I'm a Christian, but it's also how we understand multiple oppressions. So I just don't suffer from sexism. I just don't suffer from racism or classism or whatever, you know, your ism is. But it's how do we understand these multiple identities through the lens of multiple oppressions? So if you have a Venn diagram, that little circle, 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 and then the triangle that's in the middle, that is based out of people occupy multiple identities and multiple oppressions. And so how do you address all of them? It's complicated because I think for so long, we've only focused on sexism, or we've only focused on racism, and space leaves people like me, Black women, out of the conversation because I'm not a man and I'm not white. And so how do you create space to be able to talk about things that address your identity and your multiple oppressions?
Yeah, I've been, this semester I've been teaching suffrage. I've taught a whole class on suffrage, which has been just really fantastic for working out these topics of intersectionality, race, and gender, and helping my students understand it. And I remember there was a moment in my class where I'd been trying to lead them towards understanding what intersectionality is. And most of my students are white. And so helping white students understand how Black women in the US faced even more oppression because of their race and white women. And it was when we talked about the 1872 election in which Susan B. Anthony, you know, was allowed to vote. She later had to go, was arrested for it, but she or was taken to court for it. She was allowed to vote, and Sojourner Truth was turned away from voting. And it was the same election. And the only difference between them was white and black. And that really, that I think that visual example helped my students understand how some people face layers of oppression in ways that white people do not. And so I think, you know, I honestly don't understand the resistance to ideas like intersectionality and racism, because they are so clear in history. I mean, it's just, they're so easy to see in history.
I think this comes up, like, maybe it's just in subtle assumed ways where one then lists Christian as an identity, but maybe in a way that like puts them at a distance from dealing with other identities. I wonder if you have thoughts of thinking about being Christian as an identity and how it relates to other parts of self.
I mean, I feel like that's a big tension in the Black community, sometimes in academic spaces, I'll say that, because, you know, I have students, I have students of all races, but I have Black students who will say, like, Christianity is the white man's religion, you know, like this idea that Black people aren't supposed to be Christians, that we were sort of duped or, you know, like tricked into Christianity. And so there is this idea that we can't reconcile Blackness, our religious faith. And I, you know, I push back hard against that. And there's a lot of history to sort of debunk that, and, you know, and talk about, like, you know, the Ethiopian in the New Testament.
Yeah.
Talk about Queen Njinga, who converts, you know, her whole kingdom to Catholicism. Christianity is not new to Africa or anything like that. But I think that that's something that people confront a lot. But because whiteness is so intertwined with evangelicalism, because white supremacy is so tethered to evangelicalism, it is very difficult for people of color to tease that out and not throw out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, it's really hard for people to say, like, well, yes, I love Jesus, but all this other stuff, nah. And so I get it. I completely get it. But I think that, you know, we can also separate out the things that are like, not really of God, not really of Christ, and say, oh, actually, you're right. This is problematic. This is wrong. And we have to relinquish this idea. We have to relinquish this stronghold for a power struggle. And we can do that while also focusing on Christ, or we can do that simultaneously, you know? But I do think that it's a real struggle that people of color face, is like, how do I reconcile white supremacy in the church? Because it's so embedded. There's a picture I show students that their like mind is always blown. It's like from the 1920s, and it's a church, and in the church it's the Klan, and they are surrounding a pulpit, and there's a giant sign that says Jesus saves, and the minister is shaking hands with the head Klansman, whatever, and you're like, what? And I'm like, this is evangelicalism. Like, how people understand it because of that image.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, in the U.S., evangelicalism became intertwined with the Southern culture that was fighting to preserve slavery. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just embedded in U.S. evangelicalism from the very beginning. And so I think that's why it's so hard for us to separate racism and to uproot racism and sexism from white evangelical Christianity, because it was founded in both of those things. Yeah. And I think it's really hard for people who have grown up in those spaces, because they have only seen a Christianity rooted in racism and sexism. They can't see it any other way. Yeah. And this is what I think, you know, we've called this colorblind Christians, these Christians who, because this is the only water they're in, they can't see how white-centric it is. Mm-hmm. And so what you have to do is force people to step outside of that, where they can understand that they, you know, I mean, I think about this too, because churches like all the time are, you know, I think about in Waco, we have very few multicultural diverse churches. And people all the time are like, well, you know, we try really hard to get people of color to come to our churches, but they just don't come. And I'm like, you're trying to get people of color to come to your white church. And I mean, it's like, there's not even an understanding about how to maybe go to them, you know, I'm just like, if you want, it's not the first thought. And that just shows us how deeply entrenched this is, this white centric focus. And so it's a hard knot to unravel.
Thinking about the American Evangelical Church, okay, what would you name as like notable ways that our history as it relates to gender and race has harmfully formed our churches, our faith communities? And then I'm even more interested in is like, what do you see as the subtle ways where it persists in, let's just say, really well-intentioned churches? Like I'm thinking about our own communities that want to do better on issues of patriarchy, sexism, and racism.
I mean, Beth really touched on it when she talked about going back to slavery, like literally not just the country or the North and the South that are splitting apart. There are Christian denominations that some are anti-slavery and some are pro-slavery, and they literally go their separate ways. And the whole Southern Baptist Convention is about slaveholders that wanted to preserve slavery. And, you know, they drop the title slaveholders once slavery has been abolished, but abolishing the institution doesn't change what's in people's hearts. It doesn't change how people think, believe, and interact. And so those ideas about being empowered as a slaveholder, as seeing your identity as approved by God, right? Slaves obey your masters, right? These ideas, people believed that slavery was a civilized institution. They believed that it was a good thing, that they were being good Christians by subordinating and exploiting Black people. So those ideas get passed down almost like genetics, right? Over and over and over again. So that Beth is also right. We can't always see it because it's so cooked in. It's like trying to see sugar in a cake, you know. It's cooked into the product, and so that makes it really, really tough for people to be able to relinquish themselves from something because it has now become a part of their identity. So if I take away that identity, then who are you? You know what I mean? Like, are you still great? Are you still smart? Are you still godly? You know, all the things that we associate with Christianity has to be evaluated, actually has to be recreated. I mean, I think in that way, Christ is so perfect for that, because like, in order to be a Christian, we become new, we become born again, that new identity. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Beth.
No, you're so right. No, I mean, I think in white evangelicalism, and really in many ways in Christianity, that's a product of imperialism. And we have an idea of hierarchy embedded into it. And this idea that God created, that God gave some people the right to be in charge, you know. And we could also say that it's not surprising to me that these imperial ideas also came about around the same time that we have the divine right of kings in Europe, this idea that God ordained some people to be the ones in charge, to be the ones who rule. And once you accept that God has ordained some people, it is a lot easier to accept that God has subordinated more people. And so I think, you know, it's when you believe that God created men genetically, something about their bodies that makes them able to lead in a way that women cannot, it's a lot easier to also say, oh, well, if that's true, well, God also created a type of men to rule in a way that other men can't rule either. And so this idea of white superiority, which again is, you know, is how this Christianity becomes entrenched with this idea of slavery too. And Of course, that's all embedded in capitalism. Also, and making money, you know, we could think about how much money lays at the root of a lot of this too. You know, thinking about giving up people's identities, oftentimes for white people to really make room for Black people at the table or people of color at the table, it means they have to move and they have to give up some space that they are currently occupying. And that can be scary.
I wonder if you, either both of you have thoughts on how do you go and address these very difficult and important topics within a community? What does it look like to look at like the pace at which we do these things?
The pace is slow.
The pace is very slow.
The pace is like glacially slow. It is so difficult because a couple of things happen. I think one, you have to be in a place where you want to learn, where you want to know more. Part of that, I think, is helped by being in relationship with other people who do not share your background or ethnicity or experiences. And then once you develop relationships with people who are outside of that identity, like, and you learn to listen to them and to trust them and to do your own reading and then you have to act upon that. Like, I always say reading is the first step, like get information first, like, because we have unfortunately not been taught history the way we should. We have not been given the larger historical context of why this matters, why this happened, or causation or consequences or whatever. People just don't know. You know, I've had people like, I don't know what redlining is. What's redlining? Well, how do I talk about the race? Well, if you don't know what redlining is. So, I mean, there's that, right? But then after you get the information, it can be overwhelming trying to figure out, well, what can I do? I will be honest, I don't have like, here's my 3-point plan. I don't have a magic formula that's going to be like, here's your 5 steps to overcoming white supremacy and sexism. You know, like, I don't have that. I think anybody that does is like selling a bill of goods. But I do think we know what doesn't work. We know what creates harm, you know? So how do we mitigate that harm? I think that is really important. And that is it's a personal and a political choice. You know, the decisions you make, how you vote, where you live, where you put your kids in school, if you're in a position of authority, who you hire, who you fire, who you promote, like all of these things I think are so significant to understanding how we bring about change. And I don't think everybody's got to be Martin Luther King, you know what I mean? But like, do think that people have to make sacrifices and be thoughtful and careful about how they approach, you know, what activism will look like for them in a meaningful way.
I think we have to recognize that this is a slow and a hard process and that it is tied up with people's identity. You know, people all the time, people all the time ask me if I think complementarians are evil, you know, people who believe in male headship in churches. And I'm like, no, I don't believe they are evil. I believe that their identity is tied up in supporting this system. And it's really hard to extricate their identity from it. Doesn't mean it's not impossible, but it does mean it's going to take time and we're going to have to be patient for it. That doesn't mean, however, that we continue to enable it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a line. It's not that we say, oh, well, you believe that, that's okay, tomato, tomato. It's like, I understand why you believe that, but I don't. And this is why. And you know, what can we do to raise awareness among people to help them realize the blinders that they have? And you know, my husband and I have been in ministry for a long time in the white church. And one of the best ways that we have found to raise awareness is to get people out of white churches, to get them out into the community, to get them out into spaces where they encounter Christian of other denominations, of non-white denominations, and that they regularly interact with people who are not like them. And that to me does so much in helping to raise awareness. And once you can raise awareness, you can get people, you know, I like how Jamar Tisby says it, says, you know, he says white evangelicals do not ask questions. And I think that's true. If we can raise awareness, if you get people out of their spaces, suddenly we're like, whoa, why is this the way they start asking questions?
Yeah.
And if you can get people to start asking questions, you are halfway there. And that's, you know, people ask me all the, you know, with the book, like the Making of Biblical Womanhood there, you know, you didn't talk about everything. And I said, no, I was trying to disrupt the way people think. I was trying to get them to pause and ask, oh, maybe I don't know everything.
Maybe this is wrong.
And I mean, it just, when you can get people to ask questions,
you
can start moving the needle.
And get people to be, you got to be uncomfortable. I mean, like, listen, I operate in mostly white spaces all the time. The reverse, that rarely happens. And so, you know, I don't think people are saying, like, if you want to end racism or sexism, you have to quit your job and sell all your goods. Like, you know, like the person who comes to Jesus, I don't necessarily think it requires that. But like, I think we're fooling ourselves if we think we can do this from the comfort of our own homes. We're fooling ourselves. Do you think you can do it with the tweet or a Cash Nation or, you know, something that is very comfortable? Like, it is not going to require that, which is when people ask, well, what can we do? I'm like, do you really know?
Right.
Do you really want to do that? Most people don't. If we're being honest, I do think that, you know, people are willing to engage, but if we're being honest, most people don't. And that's why change is so hard, because it doesn't feel gratifying to relinquish parts of your privilege or parts of your power.
Right.
It doesn't feel fulfilling. But the thing is, when you do it with Christ at the center, it is absolutely fulfilling. It is absolutely gratifying. It is absolutely life-giving when you do this.
I love those things that you've shared. And I have seen in engaging these conversations around race and gender. I mean, admittedly, there have been ones where it has created hurt and distance for folks that it, like, either are coming from a different place than I am. But there's also been moments of surprise and joy. Like, my two of my best friendships in this past year are from people, one notably more conservative theologically and politically than me, one more progressive on both of those accounts. But we've had a deepened sense that we both care about who Christ is, want better for the church. And those have actually been the most mature, deep relationships I've had. And it's just like keeping before people, I think what you said, Beth, they're made in the image of God. They receive God's grace like I do. Powerful words. I want to go into just a couple of things that really struck me in reading your books, and I'm trying to draw out, I think, some of your wisdom here. So first to you, Kelly, you have this line, I'm quoting you. You said, knowing people of color's history does not merely add to what we know, but it changes what we know and how we know it. I'm curious to know, like, how you see this engagement with history from a perspective of faith making us into new kinds of people.
I love that quote. That quote's actually, I tweaked it. It's from Stephanie Camp, who's talking about women's history. And she says, what's history? Just add to what we know. You just don't sprinkle in women and there you go, like a side dish, you know, like it changes what we know. How we know, meaning women's history is the salt. It completely changes the flavor and the composition of what it is that you are consuming, and how the process of how you make what it is that history that we're talking about. And so, you know, I think that because we've been so programmed to think of our identities through a particular Eurocentric, patriarchal, capitalistic lens, that when you add in women, people of color, poor people, marginalized people, it's not just something else. It is a completely new way of looking at the world. So my students are often startled by that, because they're kind of like, well, now I don't know what to do with the Civil War when I look at it from this perspective. I don't know what to do with suffrage when I look at it from this perspective, or the Civil Rights Movement, or it completely changes what you know. And I think that that goes back to sort of like Romans, when we think about, like, you know, we have to renew our minds daily. Mm-hmm. We have to rethink what we know and how we know it daily. And that to me is a challenge, but it's also an invitation to be willing to not be so stuck in the things that we think are right or certain, and to make space for other people and for other ideas, and allow Christ to really expand our own understanding of him, because Christ is so big. He can't just be boxed into this white male, blonde hair, blue eyed, you know, narrative. He's so much more than that. And so that's what I meant. But there's a wonderful surprise, I think, when you allow your history and definitions of things to be expanded.
That's really beautiful. And I hear, like, you know, if Christians, we believe that we are changed ultimately by a person, and that person is Jesus. There is something like analogous to what you're saying about when you study history and you realize that there's like people involved, that knowledge has a personal aspect to it, and you start hearing stories from those people themselves who haven't had voices, it'll do something to you, right? Like it will change you.
At this point, the conversation turns to a Q&A with the audience.
Is it at all possible for churches to actually implement change that moves us to more inclusive spaces? Or do those church systems really just need to be dismantled and started over?
I'm always a hopeful person. And a lot of these white churches that are so big and so powerful, they could do so much good. There is so much potential to good within these churches. They are going to have to shift their framework, going to have to shift it away from looking mostly at themselves and looking mostly towards a few leaders. And they're going to really have to shift it outward, I think. So I do think that there is potential for change. I'm encouraged that there can be change. It's going to be hard.
How do you, or can we, respond to Christians who see views of women in marriage or the church or church leadership as a secondary issue, when it has such a monumental impact on how women understand what paths God might be calling them to in their lives?
There's an answer. I can't remember which pastor it was in Iraq, where he was talking about women being pastors or something like that. And his wife asked him a question. She said, if a woman is a pastor, is she sinning? And the question even stopped me, not because I thought she was sinning, but because I think that's a valid question. Like the real question is this sin? If it's not a sin to preach the word of God, if it's not a sin to tell people about Jesus, then well, full stop. There's no conversation, you know, to be had. I also think, and this comes out of Beth Brooks too, another thing that she said that sort of stumped me as well is that, like, when the church acts like the world,
yeah,
well, then how are we any different? How are we? We are supposed to have a new standard for how we treat all people. So if we perpetuate patriarchy, then we're no different from the world. So some of these things I think can be debunked really easily when you just sort of ask, like, is she preaching? Is she sinning? You know what I mean? Is God upset by this behavior? Is he not pleased by this behavior? And, you know, if you can answer that question pretty easily, then you can keep it moving.
Yeah, I would just say quickly, I think we have to have compassion and realize how entrenched these systems are, and that they took a while to build, they're going to take a while to unbuild. Mm-hmm. And so, but at the same time, as I said, I'm, you know, I, and you can see me, people go after me on Twitter all the time. I made a whole lot of people really angry when I wrote this article that said, that the reason when some women stay in complementary spaces is because, quote, it works for them. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, you should
no lie detected.
And I mean, but the truth is, it does.
Yeah.
It works. And it's hard for people to realize that they are being privileged by a system that hurts others.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to be real honest and say, I'm sorry, but I do believe this system is wrong. I understand why you're in it. And I love you. I want to walk with you, but I'm not going to say the system's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a really good question, really important question. How do we encourage leaders of the evangelical church to give way and make room for women of color to lead, preach, set vision, speak up without retribution? As a layperson and woman of color, it's hard to know how best to help the church change when the power structures are still steeped in white supremacy and patriarchy.
Oof, that's hard. It's hard. I think you have to have leadership that really wants to get it and really wants to change and will support you and amplify your voice and back up your voice when you speak. Because when women of color often find themselves in positions of either authority or leadership roles or speaking, they're constantly second-guessed. They're constantly undermined. They're constantly mansplained or whitesplained or whatever you want to call it. And having that support is so important. Yeah. You have to be able to speak truth to people who are in power, and people who are in power have to be willing to receive that truth and then act upon it. Not just, okay, yeah, I hear you, but here's how I show how I have heard what you said to me, right? Here's how I validate your identity and your authority within this church. I think that's really important. And so good leaders will do it, because good leaders know they don't lose anything when they're doing the work of God. But I don't know. I think it's difficult to stay in a space in which that's not being allowed.
Yeah. No, I would agree. I think the support, people who are doing this work need so much support. Mm-hmm. It's just a hard place out there. And so, you know, I think one of the best things that if you want women, if you want people of color to be able to stay in leadership, you've got to give them the support structures they need to be able to stay in leadership. Mm-hmm. I think that, and, you know, I tell people this too, in churches that don't have women in any sort of leadership, I'm saying start somewhere, get a woman in some area of leadership in that church. And if you can do that, there is potential for you to do more. Mm-hmm. And so you have to start somewhere, and you have to provide the support structures to help make change stick.
Yeah. Yeah. And you got to do more than one. You got to do more than two or three, because like, it's so hard being an only. No one wants to be an only. That's too much pressure. It needs to be much more stratified at all levels, men and women, and men and women of color, and more than one.
Are there any ways that you see that have come up for you in this conversation where you think Christ compels us to these visions of what it looks like to share power, to make hard changes within our church context, because it is a thing that Jesus is calling us to. It's a thing that God desires.
I remember my husband saying this once, if you think the gospel is easy, you're probably doing it wrong. You know, the gospel is not easy. What Jesus has called us to is not easy. Loving God and loving others above all else is not easy. That's not what we are made to do. And so I think this is a constant challenge for us, that we have to be checking our hearts. Mm-hmm. You know, our hearts are key. You have to be checking our hearts. It's, why are we doing this? What are the motives? You know, I said out on Twitter, I was sort of in a moment of kind of despondency, I think, because it was just a really hard week. And I was like, the only way I know to stand up is not to sound. And that actually, I keep thinking about that because I'm just like, we've just got to stay standing up, even when it's hard. Just got to stay standing up. And if we can do that, then we can help make that change.
So. Yeah, I agree. You know, I can't point to a lot of examples in the present that are like this. This is the beacon, right? But as a historian, I'm always encouraged by the past.
Yes.
Because I believe that these things didn't always exist, which means that there are ways of thinking about or recreating spaces in which we don't have these same struggles.
Right.
That to me is encouraging. I also think about, you know, the people I studied, the abolitionists. I can't imagine how hopeful they were or optimistic they were that slavery would be abolished. Do you know what I mean? Like, slavery's never gonna end, you know? But they still worked for it. Yeah. They still pushed for it. They still subverted and undermined the system and got people together and, you know, created, you know, eventually what becomes emancipation, eventually what becomes freedom. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, war is involved. You know what I mean? It's not easy getting these things, but I do find encouragement from people that, like, I don't know. I feel like, gosh, if you can overcome and you were enslaved, or you can overcome and you face this, and I have so much more than what they could have ever dreamed of, then I can put on my big girl pants and do the work.
Yeah.
So it's hard. It's daunting. But I think the Lord does send us encouragement. I think gives us some flecks of hope. I'm not confident that I will get to the promised land, but that's not the goal. Me getting there is not the goal. Someone getting there is the goal. And that's
right.
What I'm working
on. Oh, I love that. Yeah. I think as a historian, I think that's actually one of the reasons why I have to send this work is because of that great cloud of witnesses that I know is there and that I know who have always been working towards the same vision. Yeah. That God has given us, and that's the vision of the kingdom of God and the world that is to come. And you know, women in the 15th century were working towards the same thing. So I can keep working too.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Well, may we hear those words, and as was mentioned earlier, they be the kind of knowledge that changes who we are.
Thanks for listening to the Theology Lab podcast. You can find us on the web at highrock.org/theologylab. You can also follow us on social media like Facebook, or find Theology Lab on X at theology_lab.